Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, demonstrations continue against Turkey's prime minister.
It was first. You can't kiss on the street. You can't drink. He's changing the education and he's not asking.
White House is holding meetings on a U.S. response in Syria. Khatami backs a moderate in the Iranian presidential race. And Egyptians are increasingly concerned about an Ethiopian dam. It's all ahead. Hundreds of Turkish police in riot gear entered Istanbul's Taksim Square today, firing tear gas and a water cannon at a group of anti-government protesters. Some demonstrators threw stones, fireworks, and firebombs at police, despite urgings by authorities to stop their attacks. Earlier, demonstrators had manned barricades and prepared for a possible intervention when security forces began massing in the area. Police removed the protesters' banners that had hung from a building overlooking the square, replacing it with a Turkish flag. The police move came after Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan agreed to meet with anti-government protesters Wednesday. In a series of speeches condemning the ongoing unrest, the Turkish official has evoked memories of previous secular-based protests against his government, protests that were strongly backed by pro-army groups. But analysts say this latest unrest appears more civic-based, with youth protesting for individual freedom. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Gezi Park in Istanbul is the eye of the political storm that's raging across the country. What began as a protest to save the park from being demolished has galvanized the protesters around the country who are criticizing the Prime Minister's governance, which protesters say is increasingly authoritarian. One demonstrator, Ayşe, worked as a librarian.
Everything got started from many things. It was first, you can't kiss on the street, you can't drink. He's changing the education and he's not asking, you know, because I really want my child to be happy, and instead of thinking if she has to go to religion school. So it means that he would do anything he wants to do. It's like clapping the hands. Okay, change this. I mean, cut this, but you have to listen to these people as well.
Observers say the protest movement appears to be made up of Turkey's largely apolitical young middle class.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim.
In the center of the protest park, İhsan Eliaçuk holds Friday noon prayers, surrounded by TV cameras. 100 faithful prayed under the baking sun. Eliaçuk, who heads a left Islamic civil rights group, says his protest is heralding a new Turkey.
Biz o ayrımları burada yıktık. Layık olan, layık olmayan. Dinli olan, dinsiz olan diye bir ayrım artık yok.
He says they completed Friday prayers in Gezi Park a day after celebrating an Islamic holy night there. He says no one drank a sip of alcohol that night. He says women in headscarves walk freely in the park. Eliaçuk adds that social divisions in Turkey is between those who exploit power versus the rest of society. It's not the first time Mr. Erdogan has faced mass protests. A decade ago, hundreds of thousands mobilized in support of secularism, carrying flags and banners showing the secular state's founder, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. There were calls for the pro-secular military to intervene against changes pushed by the Islamist-rooted government. But analysts say the current unrest appears different. There have been no military demands, and images of Atatürk are few in Gezi Park.
Ama kendinden ödün vermek anlamında demiyorum. Tabii. Yalnızca bu zaten bütün bunlar
uzlaştı.
Bir hukuk değil.
Analyst İştah Gözaydın of Dorsch University has devoted much of her academic life to the battle between Islam and secularism and says his latest unrest is very different.
These groups are not relying on prior ancien regime supported by the military, etc. This is more of personal freedoms, more personal lifestyle. They have a common point of not being able to cope with the single lifestyle that the current government is trying to impose. However, just being religious believers have not made them a target by the uprising groups. It's not this polarization of believers, non-believers, or whatever, secularists, Islamists kind of thing. That is a very significant change in society.
On Sunday, Mr. Erdogan toured the country addressing a series of mass meetings of his supporters. He warned protesters.
Sabrın da bir sonu vardır. Sabrın da bir sonu vardır. Çünkü bu ülkeyi...
He says Turkish officials are going to show patience, but warns that patience has a limit. He says the time of coups is over, alluding to past interventions by the Turkish military. Analyst Göz Aydın says the current protest movement offers Turkey a chance of improving social dialogue.
These processes that's been taking place seems to be leading to another understanding of different understandings, different approaches, different lifestyles to be able to exist together. If that happens to be achieved, that means a long way has been taken in this path to democratic society.
Analysts predict that the current unrest shows little sign of abating. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
U.S. officials say a series of urgent White House meetings this week could bring a decision on whether to arm Syrian opposition rebels. Aides from the State Department, Defense Department, and other agencies have prepared the groundwork for a top-level meeting Wednesday between President Barack Obama and his national security staff. A State Department spokeswoman says a wide range of options has been prepared for the president's consideration. We asked State Department correspondent Scott Stearns what some of those options might be.
These options that are being prepared for the president are pretty much all options, with the exception of U.S. troops on the ground in Syria. That is the only definitive exemption to those all options that both the president and the Secretary of State have said. There will be no U.S. troops in Syria. Given the elimination of that option, the remaining options are all of them, are establishing a no-fly zone, are actively arming the Syrian rebels, are training more Syrian rebels outside the country, participating more actively with allies in the Friends of Syria group who are already arming some of those rebels. It would include a more active sharing of intelligence with rebels, not only about the movements of Syrian government forces, but increasingly the concern has been the involvement of Hezbollah and Iranian forces in Syria, which, according to U.S. officials, is what has, at least for the moment, turned the military tide in favor of President Assad.
These talks signal a possible bend in the administration's policy concerning Syria. Why is this change coming now?
President Obama has long said that the use of chemical weapons would be a game changer in Syria. And the French, the Brits, some elements of the United Nations have increasingly spoken of the use of sarin gas by government troops in this conflict. The French have shared that intelligence information with U.S. officials. I think that information has been in Washington almost a week now. And so this consideration of a shift in approach may be tied to the president's consideration of intelligence about the use of chemical weapons. It also cannot be taken in isolation from the significant military gains that we've seen, not only the fall of Qusair, but the massing of government troops around Aleppo. At some point, you know, if you want the rebellion to succeed, which the Obama administration does, then you can't wait forever to come down on the side of the rebellion. If you wait too long, it may not be there.
Why isn't there even a crack in the Obama position on no troops on the ground in Syria?
I think that the administration rightfully judges that there is no appetite in the American polity for having U.S. troops on the ground in Syria. As you know, as you're well aware, this is a president who has prided himself on getting out of the wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, was very careful not to involve U.S. troops in Libya. So he's certainly not going to go against the approach that he's had in the first 5 years of his administration and, you know, put U.S. troops on the ground in Syria. It's also questionable, you know, what they would be able to accomplish against the considerable risk involved.
VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns speaking with us here in our Washington studios. Syrian opposition leaders have warned the U.S. that their rebellion could face devastating losses without greater support. Any intervention in Syria essentially would pit the U.S. and regional allies, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, in a proxy war against Iran, the main arms provider for the Syrian government, and Hezbollah, which is increasingly supplying manpower. Former Iranian President Mohammad Khatami says he is backing moderate Hassan Rouhani in Friday's presidential election. Khatami's endorsement today follows the withdrawal of pro-reform candidate Mohammad Reza Aref, who says he dropped out after receiving a letter from Khatami telling him it would not be wise to remain in the race. Aref is the second candidate to drop out this week. Conservative Gholam Ali Haddad Adel withdrew Monday, leaving six men vying to replace President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Analysts say his successor will take charge of a country that is increasingly isolated, both in the region and internationally. Henry Ridgewell has details from London.
Syria's brutal civil war forms the regional backdrop for Iran's presidential election. Analysts say the recent fall of the town of Qusair to Syrian government forces, aided by their Hezbollah allies from Lebanon, reveals Iran's hand in the conflict. Hajir Temurian, a Middle East analyst who lives in Britain, says Hezbollah forces are an Iranian proxy.
The fact that there are now apparently thousands of Hezbollah fighters fighting on the side of the Syrian government against the rebels, that means Iranian involvement. But on top of that, there's been huge amount of armament and money as well.
Says analyst Shashank Joshi of the London-based Royal United Services Institute.
Iran sees the struggle inside Syria as near existential, and they see the potential fall of Bashar Assad as representing only the first step on a broader attack against Iran.
Joshi says that in reality, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, directs foreign policy.
The most we can hope for, I should say, is that a loyalist president, someone like Saeed Jalili, may be given more control of these issues if he's trusted in a way that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad wasn't.
Jalili, currently Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, said last month that the country is ready to resume talks over its nuclear program. The West believes Iran is trying to build atomic weapons, a charge Tehran denies, and has imposed severe economic sanctions. The new Iranian president will inherit a country that is increasingly isolated, says analyst Temurian.
Apart from the Hezbollah, who are very, very expensive to sustain, the Iranians have almost no friends in the world. Their friends are smugglers, people who make money out of buying surreptitiously their oil against international sanctions.
The sanctions drove President Ahmadinejad to seek new allies in Africa. In April, he visited uranium producer Niger, but came away without any big trade deals. Iran has also forged bonds with leftist Latin American countries and was the first to send condolences on the death of former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez in March. Last month, Iran's oil minister visited India to try to revive sales of crude, which last financial year plunged by over a quarter. Again, analyst Shashank Joshi.
The one hope for Iran in the longer term might be if sanctions harden into a long-term crushing apparatus of containment, they might find sympathy amongst the non-aligned nations, including countries like India.
Analysts say that, for now, the grip of Western sanctions and the guiding hand of the Ayatollah mean that Iran's new president will find little room for manoeuvre on the global stage. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Egyptians are becoming increasingly concerned about Ethiopia's plans to build a massive dam that would mean less water in the Nile River for several years. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has details from Cairo.
Cairo boat captain Adel Gamal ferries goods and people across the Nile. On a run from the banks of the nation's capital to a small island in the middle, he describes what the waters mean to him. He calls the Nile the source of life. But he, like many Egyptians recently, worry this life source is under threat. Far upstream on the main tributary, the Blue Nile, Ethiopia has begun diverting waters to build the massive Grand Renaissance Dam. As the reservoir fills in the next few years, water levels downstream will drop. Ethiopian officials say Egypt can make up the shortfall with better water management. They point out Cairo already gets the biggest share under what most Nile Basin countries say is an outdated treaty, made in 1959 when many of the countries were still under colonial rule. As a largely desert country, in essence sand with a river running its length, Egypt argues it needs every drop. Veteran diplomat Ahmed Hagag, head of the Africa Society, says the other countries have alternatives to the Nile.
They have a lot of rain. They don't know what to do with the rain. So the only country of the Nile Basin country which needs really the water is Egypt. Without Nile, there is no Egypt.
Critics say Egypt's current and former leaders failed to engage the upstream countries to protect national interests. Security specialist Sameh Seif El-Yazel argues the best chance now is to take the issue to the United Nations.
I would like it to be internationally. So everybody would be aware that Egypt will be harmed. And doesn't mean that they have to stop building their dam. No, but the way is to sit together and say what they can do.
But although the former intelligence officer suggests talks, some Egyptian politicians have spoken of sabotage. Politicians, unaware their comments were being broadcast live, suggested everything from stoking rebellion in Ethiopia to preparing military action against it. Al-Yazil says such ideas only hurt Egypt.
Ethiopia will use that. If we go to the international law one day, or go to the Security Council, whatever, they will use this against us. So please stop saying that.
President Mohamed Morsi on Monday said Egypt is not calling for war, but added all options are open. In what appears a rallying cry in a deeply divided country, Mr. Morsi says the lives of Egyptians are connected by the Nile as one great people. But General El-Yazil warns that the president runs the risk of alienating his opponents further if Egypt cannot advance its claims. Already, water shortages have hurt agriculture, and periodic cutoffs are a bane to all. Certainly, popular sentiment against the dam is running to the emotional, even religious. Boatsman Mohamed Gamal also works the river in Cairo. He says building the dam is haram, forbidden by God. It is haram, he says, that they block the Nile and take the water. Politics in Egypt may be polarizing, but the sanctity of the Nile seems the rare thing everyone agrees on. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.